starting with the Mishnah. Today's daf is Tzadi Hey. We'll start at Tzadi Dalet Amud Bet. Beged sheyatzah chutz l'kla'im. So now what happens if you're beged, that you're supposed to do, okay, if you remember, the psukim, I'll say where are the sheets? So the psukim, right, if you have the psukim in front of you, okay, you can look inside. The psukim talk about, right, just remind me which parak it's in. I just forgot.
Parak Vav.
So let's just review our psukim. Okay, we have Zotarat HaChatat, right? And then it goes on to list a bunch of dinim, starting from Pasuk Kaf. Asher, we're going to start from the middle of the Pasuk. Asher yizeh midama labeged, asher yizeh alav techabes b'makom kadosh. Remember, anything that gets on the beged, right? Any blood that gets on the beged, it has to be l'chabes b'makom kadosh, which means in the azara. So now, what if it leaves the azara? Okay, that's our halacha. Nichnas u'mechabso b'makom kadosh. You have to bring it back. Okay? Left the mikdash, you have to bring it back in and wash the blood off. Now let's just go back to the psukim for a minute. Ukli cheres asher tivushal bo yishaver, and any kli cheres that was cooked, the meat of the chata was cooked in it, has to be broken. Ve'im kli nechoshet bushala, and if it was a metal vessel, umorak v'shutaf b'mayim, you need to do this special din of mirikan shtifa. Now notice here by the second pasuk we read, it doesn't say b'makom kadosh. Okay, but the assumption is that all of these dinim have to happen b'makom kadosh. Okay, the assumption is the kibus, we're basically going to deal with three dinim. Kibus, breaking a kli cheres, and mirikan shtifa, which is a special way of washing and scouring the klei nechoshet that the chata was cooked in. So the first mishnah is going to deal with what if it left the makom kadosh. Since all of these, again, like I said, it only said it by the kvisa, but they assume that all of them have to be makom kadosh. So what happens if they leave? And the second question is, what happens if when they leave they become tameh? Now what happens? Because you have to bring it back in to do it by makom kadosh, but it's tameh, so you're not allowed to bring it by makom kadosh. So what do you do? So beged sheyatzah chutz l'kla'im nichnasu mechapso b'makom kadosh. Nitma chutz l'kla'im, but if you took it out and then it became tameh, koro, you tear it, because then what happens if you tear something? Remember we learned this with klei cheres, shviratan zoi takanatan? Shviratan zoi takanatan, meaning the way you fix the tumah, that even you can't, right, a klei cheres is known, you cannot kasher it. So what do? You break it. Once you break it, it's no longer a kli, and the tumah leaves the kli, basically. So likewise with a baguette, tear it, and then you can bring it back in. The Gemara is going to raise a problem, which is, if you tear it and you bring it back in, well, isn't the din that you're supposed to do kibbutz on a baguette, and it's no longer a baguette because you ripped it? So we're going to have this back and forth with all of the cases, really. And then, so koro nichnasu mechapso b'makom kadosh. So you tear it, you bring it back in, and then you wash it in the mikdash. Kli cheres sheyatzah chutz l'kla'im nichnas v'shovro b'makom kadosh. So again, the din of makom kadosh applies also to the breaking of the kli cheres. So if you took it out, you have to bring it back in. Nitma chutz l'kla'im. So if it became tameh when it was outside, nokvo v'nichnas v'shovro b'makom kadosh. You make a hole in it. Then you bring it in, and then you break it entirely, and you break it a little bit before, so that it can no longer be mekabel tumah, and then you break it inside. Kli nechoshet sheyatzah chutz l'kla'im nichnas umorko v'shotfo b'makom kadosh. So again, if it goes out, you bring it back in, and then you do shtifa mirikan shtifa. Nitma chutz l'kla'im, what if it became contaminated? Pochato, okay, which means you make a bigger hole in it than in the kli cheres. We'll see, you need a bigger hole for this. V'nichnasu morko v'shotfo b'makom kadosh. And then you bring it in, and then you do the marika and the shtifa b'makom kadosh. Okay, very straightforward mishnah. But like I said, we're going to have a problem.
We're about to discuss whether you can then sew the beged back or patch the hole or whatever, right?
So we're going to see. So matkif l'ravina, koro beged amar rachmana. But it says that the din of kvisa has to be on a beged, like I told you already. And therefore, how can you do this? So the answer, demishayer be kedema apoet. You leave a certain measurement, which is like a minimum size of a cloth, which it's still considered a beged, but it's already ripped in the sense that the tuma will leave it. Aval shir b'akadema aporet, okay, the idea being that what you do is you, sorry, I didn't explain it well, you take a, let's say here, so this is your beged, okay, so what do? You tear it down the middle, okay, lengthwise or widthwise, it doesn't matter, and you leave a little bit that's together. So it's now a beged with a size of a kadema aporet, a very small size at the bottom, that's still together, right? And because of that, okay, we're going to say that, therefore, it's not makabel tuma because it's torn. However, it still has, it's still called a beged because you still have part of it together.
It's not together enough to be used for its original purpose.
Exactly.
But there's something
except
you could do
that with it. Yesterday we said beged does not mean clothing, it means cloth.
Right, but even so, we could say that this cloth is not so usable because it's mostly torn. Right, well, that's going to be part of the question. So here. So now the Gemara is going to ask something, maybe it's not exactly your question, but aval shir bakadema aporet chibor hath. But if you leave a little part on it, then actually this is looked at as one whole thing. Even though it's torn, it's really, and like now we said, you could use it for all sorts of things, right? And therefore, it is considered together, and therefore should still be tameh, which means you cannot bring it inside. So what are the answer? Midera bananhu. The fact that it's considered tame still, this ripped, right, partially ripped baguette, which again is intact on one part, but the other part is ripped. So midera rabbanan, they made a gzera, okay, because we're worried that maybe you'll rip the entire thing, and therefore they made a gzera and they said, the gzera is that it's still tame, right? The reason we view this as tame, in case maybe you don't actually tear the whole thing. In other words, we want to make sure that you don't be mitaher other things. And therefore, we're going to say this is tameh, but mida oraita, it's really tahor. And therefore, because we have this din of kfisa, we allow it to go into the mikdash. So mida rabbanan, it's really tameh, but it's not tameh mida oraita. And since we have a din de oraita of kibus, this gzera de rabbanan, we're not going to relate to when it comes to bringing this item into the mikdash, because its tuma is not tuma de oraita. So we're going to allow you to do it because there's a, right, again, we have conflicting interests here. On the one hand, we want to do kibus, which is a din de oraita. On the other hand, it's tameh, but it's only tameh mida rabbanan, so we're going to allow it in the mikdash.
But had they considered beged clothing, then you can say you rip a seam of the clothing, it's no longer that object that it was, whether it was a shirt or a jacket. And then you can bring it back in, wash it, and then you can fix it. The same thing you do to the keli. It would be the same process.
No, but taking a shirt and undoing the seam is different. The other day, yesterday we learned that if it's an unfinished garment, then it's not makabel tuma until you finish it. But a garment that was already finished, that just rips a little, it's still makabel tuma, unless it's not usable. Because it has to be mamash ripped. Seam is ripped, that's still a usable baguette. Because it already had a shame kli on it. The cases we discussed yesterday, they didn't yet have a shame kli. So because of that, they weren't yet makabel tuma. But that's the whole the question about, right, we're obviously going to have to find a middle ground here between things that are enough to not make them makabel tuma, but not enough to be still called a beged or a kli or something like that.
They're using a kulas for it to be more
holy. Yeah.
Do they do that so often?
Well, again, you have an it. And it's, where do you see the kula? Because here, the way they answer this question is, it's just midera rabbanan that it would become tameh. Really, it's tahor. And it's, where's me, really? Really against Torah law. But it's not a kula, it's just the halacha. They're saying, since it's all attached, it's, right, since it's actually ripped, it's not a kli. It is a kula, in a sense, saying, but it's more like the law. The law is, this is ripped, that's not a beged. Okay. So what about, so again, they say, kli amar rahmana, how can you make a hole? Right? If you make a hole, it's no longer a kli, below klihu. So what do they answer? Shenikev b'shoresh katan. They made a very small hole, which meant that it's not makabel tuma anymore, because it's a very small hole. If you put liquids in, they would go out. But it's enough of a kli, because you could do all sorts of other things with it. You could put solids in it. You know, you could use it for all sorts of other things. This reminds me, if you remember, there was a whole diyun about what's a what size hole, this was a long time ago, we had about what size hole that you can hold pomegranates in it, right? If you remember the pomegranates, and there's all different sizes of different kind of kelim and different kind of tumah. Okay. Klei nechoshev pochato, or klei nechoshev pochato, so you make a big hole in it. So v'halav klihu, but now this really isn't a kli. In other words, okay, mele with the kli cheres, we could say it's a very small hole. But when you get to the klei nechoshev, they said it needs a much bigger hole in order to be considered that it's no longer a usable kli. That's because a kli cheres you could use for all sorts of other things. I'm sorry, a kli nechoshev, the assumption was you could use it for all sorts of other things, and therefore we need a much bigger hole to have it not mekabel tuma. And then the answer, diratzif miratzif. You take it in the mikdash, and then what do? You weld it back together. Okay, which you can't exactly do with a kli cheres once you break it, but a kli matechet, you can weld back together. So when you bring it in the mikdash, you form it back into a kli before you do kibbutz. That's a whole different answer than the other approach we've been saying about, well, you know, for this it's considered a kli, for that it's not considered a kli with the kli cheres. But now we're going to say, no, really here, what are we going to do? We're not saying it's in between, we actually fix it.
Can you say beg it back together? They didn't discuss that.
Right, they didn't discuss that. I'm not sure why they didn't discuss that. Maybe they had a better answer. You know, not sure why they didn't discuss sewing it back together.
Maybe it's because it was women's work to sew.
No, I'm sure the men sewed then there too.
Men, we talked about some of them.
Right, now I'm sure that men sewed.
In Shabbat, when we talked about, can you go out with a needle? It was male, not female.
You remember. There were also the Gardi, I forget how you pronounce what the word, the form of the word is, something with Gardi. It's like the worst profession ever. It was like the lowlives, and they were the weavers, right?
Yeah, but that's
not quite so.
No, but if you could weave, you could sew. I mean, the assumption is, but again, that was a lowlife job. I don't know if the people in Mikdash would have a lowlife job. But okay, Amarish Lakish. Me'il shenitma machniso bepachot mishalosh al shalosh u'mechabso. Mishum shenemar lo yikarea. Now we have a problem. The beged of the Kohen Gadol, okay, when he goes out, let's say he gets blood on his cloak, so now you have this din of kibus. Okay, so now again, I assume, how does this work in with the fact that we said the other day you can't wash these clothes? I assume you have to wash them, but then you can't use them anymore. And they're not usable anymore for the big day Kohen Gadol. But you have to do kibbutz. And since you did kibbutz, you can no longer use them because we said that the big day kahuna can't be washed because they don't look nice anymore. But here we're saying it doesn't matter if you plan to reuse them. No matter what, you have to get this blood out. Right? And that was what we discussed, this whole din of kibbutz. So now we're going to say, in this case, so what do? Normally, you tear it. But the big day kahuna, it says by the me'il, and the assumption is this applies also to all the big day kahuna, you're not allowed to tear them. So now you're stuck, because how do you bring it back into the mikdash? It's still a beged. So they come up with a solution. Machniso bepachot mishalosh al shalosh. You bring it in very small, okay? You know, you kind of bring it near the entrance. You have your washing stuff right there. You wash out the spot, and then you bring it out. So you bring in a very small size at a time. The assumption is also, we can hopefully assume that the blood wasn't on the entire baguette. So you keep bringing in little parts that are smaller than 3 etzvot by 3 etzvot, which we said was that small, that minimum size of the kabel tuma. And then in that way, it's not really considered tameh. It's like you're bringing in a little part of it, and you can do that and wash it. Okay. So now they have a question about this, though. Moti pravad debarava ha'avin v'harakin ein mehem mishum shalosh al shalosh. So now they say these bigadim, okay, that are thicker or soft bigadim. Okay, here we're talking about the big day kuna were thick. Okay, so now they don't have this din of shalosh al shalosh because right, you need a bigger shi'ur because they're so thick, so you need a bigger shi'ur for them to be for it to be mekabel tuma. So, in other words, I guess they're not usable, right? That 1 second. Right. And what did we say? The really small 3 by 3 etzvot could be used for a patch or something like that, but you're not going to use a big, thick piece of material for a patch. So this is going to need a much bigger shi'ur. Okay? So then
Did the Kohen have to take the clothing off?
Yeah. No, I assume he wasn't wearing it at that point.
But then what was he? I mean,
what was he wearing? No, he had other things on. He probably switched and put a new one on, you know, because this one now is no longer good because it needs washing. Okay, so it says, Eimba Mishum Shalosh Al Shalosh, and therefore you could actually bring them in bigger chunks than 3x3, because this kind of material isn't worth any, it's not value, it's not able to be used for anything at such a small size. So therefore, why do you limit it to 3x3? We can make it even bigger. So they answer, they say, no, because agav avihen chashive. Since there's still in other words, it's true that you can't really do anything with such a small piece. However, this is different from a little square cloth that's 3x3 of this thick material, which isn't usable for anything. But this little piece of 3x3 that you're bringing in is attached to the rest of a full baguette. Kind of like this ma'aporet, right? When we left the kadei ma'aporet, it's still attached to, right? The rib part is still attached to a baguette. So here also, you're still attached to the whole baguette, and therefore it's got more significance than a little piece, you know, pisat bat, a little piece of material that's 3x3. And therefore, even a minimum size of 3x3 would be considered tameh, and you wouldn't be able to bring that into the mikdash, so you'd have to bring in very small amounts. Even though normally, a piece of that material, if it were an independent piece, it wouldn't be considered tameh, but in this case it is, and therefore you have to bring in very small amounts because it's connected to the baguette. Okay, now we have a separate problem, which is habai shivat samimanim. It needs seven types of samimanim, cleaning materials, okay, in order to get out blood. Okay, this comes up in a Mishnah Nida. It says in order to take out blood, you can look at Rashi. Dam chatat v'habai dam chatat shiv'a samimanim. Doesn't the dam chatat need seven different types of cleaning materials in order to get out the blood? Hashnuyim b'mesechet nida le'inyan k'tamim. There it talks about if you have a ketem on your baguette, if you have blood, in order to put the, if you have a, let's say it's the blood gets on a baguette from dam nida, and you want l'taheret ha-beged, because remember, right, we don't have this nowadays, but in those days, their begadim would become tameh. So they want it, but you can't put it in the mikvah until you get the blood out. It's like you have to be first clean the beged, and then be mitaher the beged. So now, how do you get it out, according to there? So you have to use these seven ingredients, okay? Seven liquids. Rok tafel. Okay, that means spit. This is going to sound a little gross. Okay, actually, the spit is the better one. Spit that doesn't have anything like you weren't eating anything. You know, like a clean spit, the first spit of the day. Okay, fine. Meraglayim, urine, which seems quite odd. This is the one we're going to discuss. Okay, neter, borit, ahal, kamonia, v'ashlag. These are all cleaning materials. Okay, different what? I didn't hear you.
Megrisim.
Right, one is right. The first one's megrisim. Okay, these are all different things they use for cleaning. Okay, so now the problem's going to be that what? First of all, how do we know we need shivat samimanim? Because where the shivat samimanim were mentioned was nida. Da'amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rav Avuah, dam chatat umarot nigaim tzrichin shivat samimanim. So they refer back to this Mishnah, and they say the same way the nida blood needs these seven, also dam chatat and marot nigaim have to be washed out with these shevet samimanim. V'tanya, and it says, okay, if you remember pitu makhtoret that we say every Shabbat, what does it say? Yayin kafrisin, sayin tlata, right? And they say, oh, now I forget the words. Here, I'm going to just find it. Under pressure, can't find it in my head. Okay, sorry, let me get it. Kritu Vav. Okay, right, basically it's going to say, I'll tell you already without reading it inside, and then I'll read it to you inside, but it says that in theory, you could have soaked this material in meraglaim, but em machnisim meraglaim to the mikdash, right? Mishuma kavod. Okay? Why am I not finding it? Kritu Vav Amud Aleph. Give me a second. It's hard to find this thing. Kakosh Nimasa, here we are. here. Yayin kafrisin shesharim ba'et ha-tziporin. It was the tziporin. They would soak the tziporin in yayin kafrisin, kedei shetehei azah, to get the flavor out. V'halo mei raglayim yafin la. Mei raglayim are actually the best way to soak them, which sounds a little disgusting. Ela she'ein machnisim mei raglayim l'mikdash. Okay, there's actually an interesting debate here about this mei raglayim. Generally, mei raglayim is a term for urine. So the assumption is talking about urine, but there are those who claim, like, what kind of a craziness? Of course, how could it be that you would soak, that you would even think to soak this in urine, and that it's not really urine, and it maybe means something else. Maybe it's, well, they say that maybe it's called, like, it's a liquid that's called this because, right, why did they say it? Because the Shita Mekubetzet, he says, Yesh Omrim She'ena Kavanah L'Mei Raglayim Mamash, because how could you even think that we'd be talking about that? It's a type of herb, okay, that's called that. Why is it called that? It just happens to be called that, I guess. And then, because they suggest that maybe you can't bring it into the Beit HaMikdash because of its name. Just because it has a name that sounds very disrespectful. Okay, right? It sounds like urine. Then there's some people say that it's water from a ma'ayan that they call raglayim. Could be from its Ein Rogel that's near Yerushalayim, that maybe water that came from there. And others, people try to come up with all these interpretations because they can't even imagine how you could possibly be talking about urine. The problem is, and I think it's right, Tosfot Aros jumps on this and says, there's no way because it's so clear from the sugya in Nida that mei raglayim there means mei raglayim, urine. And there's no two ways about it. And therefore, because there's a debate there, we'll get there toward the end of our cycle, but about whether it's mei raglayim of an older person or a younger person. And so it's hard to imagine that they're actually not talking about mei raglayim, but it's interesting to see that they do have a whole debate about it. It's hard for them to understand. Okay, so anyway, the point is that the nida, you have to, right, you clean out the nida blood with these seven sanmani. Likewise, Rav Nachman says in the Avraham Ravua, also the dam chatat. And it says in Kritu that emachnisim eraglayim lamikdash mipnei kavod. So how could you possibly do kibbutz with the sheva sanmanim in the makom kadosh when you can't bring eraglayim into the makom kadosh? So they're going to suggest v'chitema demivle lehu b'hadei shivat sanmanim u'ma'ar lehu lekulu kechad. Maybe you could say this goes back to our dinei bitul. You mix all the seven cleaning mixtures together. At that point, you're not exactly bringing mei raglayim into the mikdash. The mei raglayim is batel to everything else, and it's not so. There's no lack of respect. To take the tziporin and soak it in mei raglayim is using mei raglayim just as mei raglayim. If you mix it up in this whole mixture, it could be okay. But if you want to say that, remember, anytime we say b'chitema, they're going to reject it. B'chitema means, and if you were to say this, well, that's not going to work. V'hatnan, he'eviran shelo kesidran. Okay, this is back in Nida. It says if you use them not in the order, okay, you have to do it specifically in this order. First use this, then use that, right? It sounds like a cleaning guide, right? The best way to Google, like, what's the best way to get out stains? This is, right, the Gemara tells you, if you want to get out blood stains, this is what you do, okay? If anyone has blood stains, you can try it, okay? Try to get all the materials. I don't know if you can anymore, but anyway, maybe skip the Mayrag line. What'd you say? That's true. It might be the easiest to get, right? Because they talk about it. I didn't go through the details, but some of them come from a particular mineral, you know, that who knows if we, you know, we can find. Anyway. Heviran shelo kesidran, o shehevir shivatan ke'echad, if you do it not in order, or you do all at once, lo asav lo klum, so you can't do that. V'chi tema demivle la bahad echad mesamemanin, maybe you just mix the mei raglayim with one of them. But it also says that you have to rub it with each material, substance, three times. So there you have it, then you can't mix it up with anything else. It says there in the Mishnah. Okay, it says, in other words, number one, you have to do it in order, right? Each one of the seven in order, not mixed together, and each one has to be scrubbed on its own three times. So you can't say that. So now they say, Ella demivla la berok tafel. This is why I said you thought the spit sounded disgusting. The spit is actually seen as the respectful thing. So the respectable item. So you absorb, you basically mix it up with the rok tafel. Why is that? How do we know you can do that after we just said each thing has to be done on its own? Rish Lakish had the shita that the rok tafel was mixed up with each of the substances. So in the end, what do we say? You can use it for kibbutz because you've mixed the meraglayim with the rok tafel, and therefore it's not disrespectful in the mikdash to bring the meraglayim. Okay. Now we're going to move on and talk about the three different halachot again. Echad shebishelbo, ve'echad she... Actually, no, sorry, not all three. Now we're talking just about the breaking of the klicheres and the mirikan shtifa of the klei nechoshet. Now this a little bit crosses over into dinei kashrut, which we're going to discuss now. Echad shebishelbo, ve'echad she'ira letocho rotech, whether you cooked in it or you poured it, it's not only, what did the pasuk say? Asher bushalbo, right? In b'kli nechoshet bushala, right? If it was cooked, or kli cheres asher tibushalbo. So what do you see? It has to be cooked in it. But now the Mishnah says, not only cooked in it, but also, the same way you would have dinei kashrut, if you poured boiling hot soup that had the meat of the chatad, or the boiling hot liquid of the meat, into the kli cheres, or into the klei nechoshet, right? It doesn't matter whether you cooked in it or you pour the boiling water into it. Echad kodshei kodashim ve'echad kodshim kalim tu'unim mirika u'shtifa. Here we get to our big halacha that we saw before, that we discussed a while ago, that even though the pasuk is about chatat, this applies across the board to all korbanot, according to Tanakama, kodshei kodshim and kodshim kalim. Okay? Everything needs mirika u'shtifa. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Kodshim Kalim ein tu'unim mirika u'shtifa. Rabbi Shimon said this is only true for Kodshim Kalim, for Kodshim Kodshim, not for Kodshim Kalim. Okay, so there's a debate. Within this, there's a few things I want to discuss before we move on. First of all, this Mishnah was actually only talking about, I said it wrong in the beginning, it's only talking about mirika u'shtifa. It's not referring right now to the Kli Cheres. So it's unclear from here whether this would also be the case for breaking kli cheres. Do you have to break a kli cheres also in this situation, kodshim kalim also? So some say yes, you do. And the Rambam says, interestingly, he says no. Kli cheres you don't have to break if it's kodshim kalim. However, he says that you need to do mirikan shtifa, and that he puts it down a level. He says a kli cheres with a different, right, with a kodshim kalim, just needs mirikan shtifa. It doesn't need to be broken, which is interesting because if the whole theory about kli cheres is it's different inherently and it can't ever be, you know, then he obviously has a different approach to what this is all about. Now it's unclear what, right? Remember we talked about it's possible we're worried about one of the main things is we're worried about notar it being left over past the zman. So that's why it applies to both kochim and kochim kalim because you're going to end up it's still going to be in there. So how does Rabbi Shimon explain it? What about Kodshim Kalim? What happens when it becomes notar 2 days later, right after your shlamim? Do the 2 days are up? So the assumption is that even though he doesn't need Mirikan Shtifa, even Rabbi Shimon agrees that you have to do Hagala, which is koshering it. In other words, they definitely have to be koshered after the time elapses because otherwise you're going to cook it in notar meat, which is, right, the notar flavor is going to come out into your food.
So this is all happening in the courtyard. You can't take anything out. And you're assuming that this is...
Well, it's not that you can't take it out. It's that if it goes out, you have to bring it back in. Now, the din is that the shtifa merika has to happen in the makom kadosh. There's also an interesting debate. When it comes to kodshim kalim, there's a debate about whether it has to be done in the makom kadosh or does it have to become in the makom kadosh of the kodshim kalim, meaning kodshim kalim can be eaten in all of Yerushalayim. So maybe the merikan shtifa for kodshim kalim can be eaten in all Yerushalayim. There's also a debate about that, which is interesting.
Because it's a practical consideration because of all the kodshim kalim, regular people who came to bring karbanot could eat. So you're thinking that they're cooking in all of these.
Yafeh. So if they're cooking outside, to have to bring them into the mikdash seems a little crazy. And that's why that opinion makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. The problem with that opinion is it says makom kadosh, and the pasuk, so if you're going to say it applies to makom kadosh, then it has to be makom kadosh. But probably the other ones who say what you're saying is it doesn't make any sense. What, everyone's going to bring their pots back to the mikdash? What kind of omis in the mikdash also to have all the kutcha? Right, exactly. Right, the more we learn, the more we learn how really crowded it was. What's the process of Mirikan Shtifa we're going
to
discuss?
Why is if the purpose is to get rid of notar, then what's the difference whether it's kushim kushim or kushim kalim? Meaning, why do they change? Why is the process different? Why would you think the process could be different?
So the pasuk is only referring to the chata when it says Marikan Shtifa, and that's why. So the whole question is, like we've seen in many, many cases of korbanot, this detail is only mentioned there, this detail is only mentioned there. Do we say we learn from this to all things that are like it? Kachim, kachim, right? Chatat is kachim, kachim, kachim. So let's learn to kachim, kachim. Or do we say, no, 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 it's a deen that would apply to any kind of korban, and then we have to get rid of it. It could, and as again, I assume Hagala really gets it out. I mean, right. In general, we use Hagala for kashering purposes. But here, there's an extra chumrah, I kodshe kodshim, that it needs this special din Mirikan Shtifa. Or, like the Tanakhama, no, it's a special din by all korbanot. Okay? Not that, it's not necessarily whether it works or doesn't work. It's a matter of what the Torah told us to do and what we're supposed to do. So that's why I said, even if you say kodshim kalim don't need this, they clearly need Hagala. It's not like you can just leave it and it's not an issue. Okay, Tanu Rabbanan. So now we're going to talk about some other details about this. Asher tevushalbo, eli ela shebishelbo. Again, we're going to have the source for how we get to this halacha, the even ira l'tocho roteach, right? So from the pasuk, it sounds like only if you cook in it. Ira l'tocho roteach minayin. Where do you get it if you poured it into it? Talmud lamar, v'asher tevushalbo yishaver. Okay, so now, ignore the word tevushal. It's really asher bo yishaver. Whatever was in it, it needs to be broken. This is the pasuk about the part of the pasuk about the kli cheres. The point is that whatever's true for that would also apply to the merikan shtifa. And therefore, since it says bo, it just could have said vasher tevushal yishaver if it was cooked in it. You know, and again, bo really does seem kind of necessary. But again, it's one of those things to say anything that went in it would mess it up, and therefore yishaver. By Rami Bar Chama, here comes Rami Bar Chama with his question: Tlao ba'avir tanur mahu. What if, and this was the way they generally cook the chatan, okay, this isn't one of those Rabbi Yirmiyah Nuni questions, but this is actually a very practical question, okay, you have your oven. Your oven is like this. It has a bottom piece. We've talked about it. It's open on the top. So you have your fire burning at the bottom, okay, so you have at the bottom of the oven is all the wood pieces. And you put on a shipud, on a stick, you put your meat, and it goes inside the airspace of the oven, but it doesn't touch the walls of the oven. It's not like when you cook in a pot and it gets into the walls of the pot. Here, you just put it in the airspace of the kli. Anything that falls from it falls onto the wood. It doesn't get absorbed into the kli because it gets absorbed into the wood, which is burning. So that's not an issue. So there's actually nothing absorbed into the sides of the kli. So he says, if that's the case, tila'oba avir tanur ma'u. Abishal ubiluahu dekapi rachmana. Is it cooking and getting absorbed? And is the problem of cooking because it gets absorbed into the sides? Odilma abishal below biluah. Or does it mean asher tevushalbo? It doesn't matter how it was cooked in it. Even if it was cooked in the airspace of the oven, right? Even though nothing actually got absorbed into the walls. Okay, that's a very good question, right? We started off with just cooking. We added, well, also if it's just absorbed, even if it wasn't cooked, meaning if you pour from your, you know, we generally call that kli rishon, where it was actually cooked in, and you pour it into another kli, so now it's in a kli sheni. So now, would we say, right, that's a problem, because it's still going to get absorbed into the walls. But then the question is, what if you just cook in it, but there's nothing that gets absorbed into the walls? What's the halacha there?
We just jump from kelim, from dishes to the oven. You call the oven a kli also that you're going to add.
Well, right. So achat shebishelbo generally, right. So we were talking about, right here, I guess it could be, yeah. The meat, I think they generally just cooked in an oven on a shipud. I don't think the meat was ever really cooked in a pot. I don't think it was cooked in pots. They didn't boil it. They roasted it usually. I mean, in theory, you could have boiled it, I guess. Remember, they said they could do it any way they wanted. Well, the tanurim were made of cheres also. Okay, ovens were made of cheres. We're now going to be mostly dealing with ovens. They're not stationary. They were these clay or metal, big heavy, you know, right, that we use. Well, we're going to see soon that they only use metal things in the mikdash. This is kind of a theoretical question because we're going to see later that the ovens in the mikdash were metal exactly for this purpose, so that you wouldn't have to break it all the time. Otherwise, you'd end up having to break it.
Why wouldn't they boil meat or make stew? Or something?
Right, so they might have also. But here they're talking about a case where you weren't using a pot. In other words, right, in theory, they could have also boiled it. We said they can make it any way they want. But I assume most of the time they roasted the meat. right?
And then it wouldn't splatter on the sides of the oven, just saying.
No, so the idea, right, so the idea is that if you're roasting it over the fire, that it generally goes down. It doesn't go to the sides. Right. Again, if it's like a closed barbecue, I could see maybe more, but if it's open, then generally it would drip down. It wouldn't necessarily splatter out to the sides as you're cooking it. Maybe when you're eating it, you know, things splatter a little bit. Okay. So now, here we come and try to answer the question. Amar Rav, Tashma, let's learn from here. Echad shebishel bo, ve'echad she'ira l'tocho roteach. So they're going to say, since it says whether you cook in it or you pour boiling water in it, that was our Mishnah. So what do they learn from here? Balua below. Oh, so they're going to, okay, that's it. They want to say basically, since it gives you all the option, well, okay, right, you can say all different things here, but their assumption is if you're bishelbo or you pour rotchim, which sounds like bishul below bilua would also be a problem because they're saying bishul and bilua, either one. So now the Gemara says, no, balua below bishul lo kamibailan. I wasn't talking about if it got absorbed without cooking. That's ira l'tocho rotech. Ki kamibailan bishul below bilua mai. In other words, this doesn't really address the bishul below bilua. It was talking about bishul with bilua and then bilua without bishul. But I want to know what about bishul without bilua. So therefore, they bring another source. Tashma. Da'am rab nachman amar rab ravua. Tanur shel mikdash shel matechet haya. Here we have it. The tanur in the mikdash was made of metal. Bishul below bilua lo kapid. And if you thought that bishul below bilua wouldn't be an issue, nyavit shel cheres. In other words, why do you think they made matechet? The reason they made matechet was so that you don't have to break the oven of cheres. Now, if the korbanot were generally roasted and it was roasted over the oven like this, and if it was cooked, I guess it was cooked in pots and not in the oven. So if you're roasting it in the oven, you would roast it over, like I said, it would drip down onto the wood, not onto the kli cheres. So why would you need to make sure that it was a metal oven, especially when most of the ovens in those days were cheres? You know, obviously, the reason they did it with metal is because you'd have to break the kli cheres, which shows you the bishul below bilua was a problem. Their assumption here is that the only thing you would cook in those ovens, because that's what they're talking about, is the meat of the korbanot. But now they're going to say, oh, no, there were other things they cooked, okay? It wasn't just that. Kevan de'ika shayre menacho de'afiyatam betanur de'ika bishul ubilua avdinan shamatechet. The reason why they did this was because you also have the mincha. The mincha, if you remember, the way they baked bread was they would stick the bread, it's like we make pita nowadays, right? You stick the pita on the, right, if you go out bashetach, right, you stick it on the sides, and then you peel it off the sides, right? That's what they would do. That's how they would make it in the oven. The difference between the pita, we generally make it, if you ever go to those places, bashetach, they make it on the outer part. They would make the bread on the inside of the oven, and they would kind of put it on up against the walls, and then there was this whole act of ridiyat hapat. It came up in Shabbat because it's like an important melacha. It's considered taking the bread off the walls of the oven. So in that case, there's bishul and there's bilua, right? And the mincha also has the din of notar and therefore would be an issue. So that's why they were shalmatechet and therefore it can't teach you anything about bishul below bilua. So in the end, they don't have an answer. And halacha lemaase, they say, since we don't have an answer, you have to be machmir. And therefore, bishul below bilua, they claim halacha lamasa would be a problem. Hahu tanur da'atru betichaya. Now they talk about, since we're talking about tanurim, so now we have a tanur where they took the fat of the animal and they greased the sides of the oven with the fat of the animal. Asra rabba bar halilai lemichla lerifta leolam. If you bake bread then, once you put the oil on the walls, you can't ever make bread in this oven forever. In other words, the flavor of the oil never comes out of the walls. Vafilu b'milcha, you can't even eat bread with salt. What's the concern? And it's not kosher, but the concern is that you'll eat the bread with chalavi. This is the same reason, I don't know if you're aware, right? We talked about this. That you can't make, there's an issur to make chalavi bread, okay? There's ways around it, but there's issues with making chalavi bread because we're worried you're going to eat it with meat. If you make it in a way that looks like regular, like if you make your challahs, and sometimes you make them chalavi, and sometimes you make them basari, and they look exactly the same, so there's a bit of a halachic issue about this. I think there's ways around it, but I see you're laughing. What's the situation?
I made chalavi bread for Sukkot and then shredded it and percolated the chicken with it the week after Shiva.
Oops. Okay, there
something
you have it.
Exactly like that.
Exactly.
And now it's on tape.
Okay, so that's why they say, even with salt, you can't eat it, meaning why salt? Because that's what people would eat. Like, nobody would eat bread without salt. So they're saying, even if you ate your bread just with salt, you can't even eat your fleishach bread, you know, that's had the fleishach tam in it, because you're worried that you might eat it with dilma ata lemichle bekutcha. You might eat it with your kutach, right? That was that disgusting, you know, or, right, fermented, they had milk, sour milk, it sounds a little like yogurt maybe, but sour milk and breadcrumbs and salt and all that. But anyway, the point is you might eat your bread with the kuta. Okay, so right now we start with this tanur. Rabba Bar Ahilai says you can't ever fix this oven, and you can't ever make bread in this oven, because it'll always have the taste of meat in it. Meitive, but now we have a source that seems to contradict. Ein lashina ta'isa b'chalav. Vimlash kolapat kulasua. Here's the dairy bread source, okay? You can't knead your dough with chalav, and if you do, the whole pot is asura, mipnei hergel avera, because we're worried that you'll make that mistake. Kayotsebo, likewise, ein tashina tatanur ba'aliyah, you can't rub the tail, the fat from the tail of the oven, of the animal, on the walls of your tanur. Vim tash kolapat kulasura. Okay, this sounds exactly like we said, but here comes the difference. Ad she'asika tatanur, all you have to do is fire up the tanur, burn it up, and then the flavor will be gone, right? Kind of koshering it.
Did that.
Did that what?
After I cooked the chicken and found the problem, I koshered the oven.
Ah, okay, yafeh. So, tiyufta de Rabba Bar Ahilai, tiyufta. So they say, in fact, this is a question, Rabba Bar Ahilai, because Rabba Bar Ahilai says, can never be fixed, and this source says it can be fixed. Amalei Rabbina l'Rabashi. So he says, well, if that's the case, now that we've knocked out his opinion and it's not a problem forever, Amai Amarav, why did Rav say, K'teirot b'pesach yishavru? This is such an interesting thing. We talk about waste and all that, and you think about in those days, right? They didn't waste anything. According to Rav, on Pesach, you have to break all your chametz kelim. Why? Because the flavor that got absorbed in them, the chametz before Pesach, is now going to be considered chametz she'avar alav Pesach. So even after Pesach, you won't be able to use them, and you can't ever fix them. So why can't you say we kosher them? Amar le Rav, mokela b'hahi b'shel matechet. Rav would say that what we were talking about before about the oven, and it can be koshered, is a matechet oven, but not a klicheres oven. And a klicheres, for sure, you would have to break. The bite ema, or the second answer is to say, b'tanur shalcheres, it is talking about a tanur shalcheres, and even so, you still can kosher it. Why? Zeh seikomi b'fnim, v'zeh seikomi b'chutz. What's the difference between a kdera? We always think you kosher a kli, right? So you put the fire at the bottom, and it's taking out the flavor that's inside the walls of the pot, which don't actually come in contact with the fire, the inside, right? The fire is on the outside. So that kind of koshering doesn't work for a kli cheres. But if you have a tanur that's a kli cheres, and the fire is inside the tanur, and the flavor is inside the tanur, then you can actually kosher it. Okay? Because then, even something that can't be koshered can be koshered because the fire is on the inside. Okay? So then they're going to say, v'navid hasakami b'fnim, so why don't you just take your pot, that's your kli cheres pot, that you normally cook on the inside, and the fire is normally on the outside, and put the fire on the inside. And that way you can kosher the pot. That's why do we say you have to break it? Again, they'd always rather not break anything. So they say, chayes alayu de mitbere. We're worried that you won't do it so well because you're worried it's going to break. You're worried if you put the fire on the inside, it might break the pot. So you won't do that, and maybe you'll put just a little bit of fire, or you'll put the fire at the bottom anyway, even though you're supposed to do it inside. So that's why they don't allow you to do it. Therefore, they say there was this type of thing that they would make bread, and even though most of the bread was made in these ovens where the fire was inside and the bread was inside, there's a certain type of oven that they would use where the fire would be underneath And that would be a problem if you would, right? In that case, if it was made of cheres, you wouldn't be able to kosher it, because if the food went on the inside, you know, it was like, I think the way I viewed it was like a frying pan type thing. Frying pan shape, where underneath you put the fire and on top you put the bread inside, and that, or it could be maybe the other direction of, you know, maybe the opposite shape of a, but either which way, the fire was on the bottom, the bread was on top, and that would be a problem.